Okay.
How was for the devotees of Mr. Kesper?
Now that didn't do so well.
Are they exempted? For people, for some of the devotees who went to Harinam Basri, are they exempted or?
There was only a couple that didn't do it, and they did it during the week, as far as I understood. Yeah. Did you do it? Yeah. No. Okay.
Tomorrow.
Okay. All right. Let's have a look at chapter 10 of the Srimad Bhagavatam. So, what have we learnt so far? What have we looked at in the previous chapters? We've heard the sages ask Sudha Goswami about the Srimad Bhagavatam, about what is the essential teachings of the Vedas, which has been described as the Srimad Bhagavatam, that is the cream of all Vedic literatures, and it is also the essential religious process that one should follow, especially in this age of Kali. Therefore, the sages had more inquiries about the nature of Srimad Bhagavatam, which they understood to be non-different from Krishna and to be the guiding light towards salvation in this age of Kali. And therefore, Sudha Goswami has described in succession the compiler of the Srimad Bhagavatam, Srila Vyasadeva, all the steps that led up to Srila Vyasadeva's ultimate realization, which is presented in the Srimad Bhagavatam. How he presented that to the most qualified person to hear the Srimad Bhagavatam in the form of Sukadeva Goswami, who being an Atmarama, a self-realized soul, would certainly distribute the message of the Srimad Bhagavatam without any material motives that may distort the message, the pure message of the Srimad Bhagavatam. And how ultimately the next topic leads to the fact that Sukadeva Goswami then spoke the entire Srimad Bhagavatam to Parikit Maharaj, and gradually Sudha Goswami is bringing us to an understanding of the birth and activities of Parikit Maharaj. And we see that Parikit Maharaj was a devotee from the very womb. Gradually we will see over these chapters how he was raised by Yudhisthira Maharaj and the other Pandavas, who were also great devotees of the Lord, so much so that Krishna wanted them to rule over the entire world. So it was these great personalities, these great devotees, which actually raised Parikit Maharaj, who would be, who would later hear the Srimad Bhagavatam. So in this way we gradually learn of the greatness of Parikit Maharaj in hearing the Srimad Bhagavatam. So in this way, when we see that the greatest personalities who are excel all others in pleasing the Supreme Lord are the ones who are compiling, hearing, speaking, and discussing the Srimad Bhagavatam, we understand that this is certainly another way to confirm Srimad Bhagavatam as the greatest, most spotless, transcendental literature of all time. And we can also understand, because of the background of when it was presented at the beginning of the age of Kali, that it is not only the greatest transcendental literature, but it is really the being so powerful, it is the only remedy for the ills of Kali Yuga. So these are the things that we're hearing about the Srimad Bhagavatam. And in chapter 8, 7 and 8, of course, the topic of Srimad Bhagavatam, which is Lord Sri Krishna, is then discussed directly. Lord Sri Krishna is introduced, his pastimes, specifically in relationship with his devotees, into the topics of the Srimad Bhagavatam, and we understand that the devotees have all described him as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. It has been described by Vyasadeva, Sukadeva Goswami, Sudha Goswami, Queen Kunti, Bhishma Dev. They have all described Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead and given various evidences and from his activities and from logic and reason and from Shastra to confirm that he is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. As the Supreme Personality of Godhead, we understand that the whole material creation is his property and should be managed according to his will and his desire. And therefore, Bhishma Dev pointed out to the Pandavas that it was certainly Lord Sri Krishna's desire that all the events leading up to the Battle of Kurukshetra took place in order that Krishna could establish his own devotees as rulers of the world. And therefore, in chapter 10, we get to the point where Sudha Goswami is describing how the world was ruled under the reign of Maharaj Yudhisthira, who was directly representing the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Sri Krishna, and how everything flourished very, very nicely. So that's how we've gotten to the point where we're at in the 10th chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Yep. Is it the first time that Maharaj Parikshit has listened to Shukadeva Goswami, or is it the first time that the king of his caliber has heard of this Srimad Bhagavatam in time of passing, or does he know some knowledge before? at the time of his sitting down on the banks of the Ganges with Sukadeva Goswami. He was trained under the Maharaj Yudhisthira. Excuse me. Hello? You there? Are you? Yeah, I'm just giving class. Yeah. Maharaj Parikit was trained, of course, how to rule the kingdom, all the Kshatriya skills, so you know there's a huge amount of education and training in knowledge, character, Maharaj Parikit would have been somewhere in his 30s, I guess, at the time, about 30, because Maharaj Yudhisthira ruled 36 years after the Battle of Kurukshetra, and Parikit Maharaj was born just after the Battle of Kurukshetra, so he would have been about 36. So he would have been about 36 when he took over the rule of the kingdom, and as far as I understand, he hadn't been ruling long, Parikit Maharaj, and he was then cursed by the son of a brahmana. So most of his training, he was very, very well educated in what was necessary, particularly for him to rule the kingdom as a devotee. But not Srimad Bhagavatam. Well, it's not surprising. There are people within, the Indian community, within the Hindu community, who go through an entire life and never hear of Bhagavad Gita. And even some of those who know it seriously, even some of those who hear a Bhagavad Gita, still, when you mention Srimad Bhagavatam, they have no idea. So you can be a person can be quite knowledgeable within literatures, even within our time, and never even hear a Srimad Bhagavatam, or may hear of it and never get the chance to study it. generally, these things were studied. The difference then, of course, is that if you studied something at that time, you studied under someone who was known to be, an expert professor of that book or literature. Nowadays, everyone claims to be, one of the difficulties, of course, that I have as, doing a lot of the ceremonies, is that you have so many Brahmins and so-called Brahmanas all over India especially, and some locally, although they're not particularly knowledgeable on Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita and Narada Pancharatra, specific religious duties that were performed in the age of Kali, or any age, they advise people on all subject matters. People take that here's a Brahmin, he knows everything. That's how they take it. So quite often the Indian community, they want to know something, they'll just call up the Brahmin. The Brahmin just yes you do this, although they're not, they'll teach, although then no one even asks them, which section of the Vedas are you proficient in. previously the system was that, you know, just like we read earlier, was it in the 4th, 5th chapter, the Śrīla Vyāsadeva then gave sections of the four Vedas to certain professors who then subdivided them, and each had a, so if you wanted to learn a section, you didn't just go to anyone, you went to a person who is known to be the professor, you know, and the best you could find in that literature. So just because you even you've heard of Śrīmad Bhagavatam doesn't necessarily mean you've got the opportunity to speak it. When the opportunity came in the form of Sukadeva Goswami, it was taken. So it's not like now, the difference is now, you know, that in Kali Yuga everyone, you know, everyone thinks that they have opinion about everything and they know nothing about anything. So therefore it's, you know, not that surprising. It's happening now. That was flashing there. Well, that means that they're on, is that correct?
Yeah.
Are they on?
They're on,
yeah. They're on.
Yeah.
For instance, as I said, one of the difficulties I had, that someone, quite often when people want to do a ceremony, they'll ring up an astrologer in India and they'll say, I want to do a yajna next week, can you tell me what is the best tithi? So because they've asked for a yajna next week, they get the date for next week. Oh yes, the best day will be Friday next week. See, but factually, all they've given them is one fraction, like the tip of an iceberg. If they had said, you know, in the near future, what is the best possible muhurta, they'll say, oh, you have to wait 3 months because although there are tithis, so many planets are badly situated. You wait 3 months, 6 months, then you do your yajna. That. So, and then they will question, you know, myself, that like I'll choose a day for them, and then their priest will say, Nana, you cannot do it on this tithi. And I have to explain the whole astrological science that, you know, it's not just a tithi, there are 9 planets and a whole combination of effects. They may have given you the tithi, but so many other things are, you know, have to be considered, see. So, you know, it is one of the difficulties that people have no knowledge, very little knowledge, which is dangerous, of only a few little parts of Vedic sciences, but they present themselves as being knowledgeable in all the Vedas. I am a Brahmin, I know the Vedas. That's it, all the Vedas. And people accept them like that. But that's not how it was previously. So it's not unusual that, you know, Prigit Maharaj hadn't yet learnt the Śrīmad Bhagavatam. Can we say they've already attained the perfection? Yeah. Yes. Therefore, you see that one of the first questions that Prigit Maharaj asked Sukadeva Goswami was that now, you know, I've come to the stage of death. What should one do at this stage of death? Should I be chanting the holy name of the Lord? Hearing chants? You see? So Yes, the understanding is there, but the etiquette is still to inquire from the spiritual master. And in doing that, one's faith and understanding and ability to execute that becomes fully matured. In the same way that, you know, Srila Prabhupada said that whatever he learnt from his father, which is basically the whole Vaishnava culture, was made solid, you know, a solid foundation by his spiritual master. So everything was there. But without Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati Thakura's influence, Prabhupada may not necessarily have had everything required to travel through, you know, to the Western world and preach. That sense of focus and clarity and you know, mission was you know, everything that required, all the instructions and everything, you know, that was made very solid. So the ability really was given there by Bhaktisiddhanta. So yes, perfection is there. So in the spiritual world, there's perfect, more perfect, and most perfect. And you know, we also by just like in the previous module, we looked at the life of Narada Muni, and we looked from his life at what are some of the principles that we can apply in our personal life and in preaching. So Krishna performs pastimes with his devotees, and in that way we are able to more easily follow the Lord's instructions. So, for instance, if Krishna said that, you know, here are the steps on of bhakti leading from the beginning to the end, and you follow this, we wouldn't be able to do it. But when we see, oh, okay, you know, now let's look at Narada, because he's actually done it, and then, oh yes, it becomes very clear. So if you're cooking a cake, you tell a child, you know, to cook a cake, which is something simple compared to going back to Godhead. And you say, you know, how to sift the flour and do this, do that, and the proportions, you know, and to, you know, put a bit of butter on the tray, and so many different things, and the heat and everything like that. And you give the instructions to a child, still very difficult for them then to go in the kitchen and do that. But after telling them, and then they see you do it, very easy. So Krishna gives us that opportunity through these devotees to see firsthand, and it makes it very easy. Krishna in the same way that you know, we become covered, you know, by illusion, we forget things or can't come to a certain understanding because of the material energy, but Krishna's pure devotees actually go through a similar thing, but under Krishna's spiritual energy, so that they sometimes the realizations which is sort of within their heart don't fully manifest in their consciousness until such time as Krishna is ready. We see that Maharaj Yudhisthira, you know, Krishna himself tried to convince him that, you know, you should rule the kingdom. You haven't done anything sinful. and you know, it is very necessary that you rule the kingdom. But he couldn't be convinced, not by God personally, not by Vyasadeva. So many people tried to convince him, but because Krishna wanted to glorify Bhishma and to he wanted Bhishma to see the Pandavas now, you know, ruling the world. He wanted to glorify Bhishma. So many different reasons. Therefore, he arranged that Yudhisthira, I will try and convince you, but actually, I don't want you to be convinced within your heart. So he did not allow that until such time. And then, when he heard from Bhishma Dev, he was convinced. So, you know, one of the first questions that were asked in the Purva Svadvaya questions in the chapter 10 is that why couldn't Yudhisthira Maharaj enjoy the results of his victory, right? And as it describes in the purport, that he could not enjoy the results of his victory because his cousins were all killed in the fight, right? So many relatives were killed. So that's there. Now we have to look at that. So that's of course the we look at different ways of, look at that from different aspects. One, he couldn't enjoy it personally, in that he wasn't going to take you know, personally lavish himself in the booty and rewards according to the war, because that would out of respect for so many people who had died. At the same time, we should understand that Maharaj Yudhisthira, being a great devotee of the Lord, was actually very would have been enjoyed ruling the kingdom, knowing that Krishna was very satisfied. I think it describes in verse one of these verses that Lord Sri, the second verse, Lord Sri Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is the maintainer of the world, became pleased after re-establishing Maharaj Yudhisthira in his own kingdom, and after restoring the Kuru dynasty, which had been exhausted by the bamboo fire of anger. So Yudhisthira would have taken great pleasure in the fact that, you know, Krishna was pleased. So, you know, in one sense, he's certainly not going to take any material personal sense gratification, but on a spiritual platform, it would have given him great satisfaction to know that he had pleased Lord Sri Krishna, and Lord Sri Krishna was pleased. but we see, you know, the point being that Krishna's spiritual energy, Yoga Maya, is orchestrating Krishna's plan. And therefore we see that such devotees as Maharaj Pariksit appear to be in, although they're, you know, fully perfect, self-realized souls, great devotees, already perfect devotees, it appears that they, you know, come to perfection. It appears like that. That's really just to facilitate Krishna's pastimes, so that we can follow in their footsteps on the path of perfection. In other words, if someone is, let's go back to our example of the cake. You know, Mum's shown, telling the child how to make a cake, tells the little daughter or son how to make the cake, and then pulls a cake out of the, you know, out of the fridge, what have you, It's already perfectly cooked, perfectly iced. Everything's perfectly done. It's very hard to follow the steps to perfection. See what I mean? And even if there's some mishaps, the mother may be shown the child, you know, how to make the cake, and even the things that go wrong are actually very beneficial, you know, for the child. They learn. So we see the Bhakti Vinod Thakur, you know, when he was it appeared that he was an impersonalist at the beginning. You know, at one stage he says in his writing that he admits that I identified myself as being one, you know, with I think it was the Paramatma. You know, he at some stage in his you know, studies, he was attracted to the impersonal philosophy. So it appears like that. You know, these they're all pastimes to show a progression of thought. So actually, if you follow back to Vinod Thakur's life, there's a progression of thought from looking into religion, Christianity, Muslim religion, this one, that one, you know, coming back to the Vedic wisdom, and then through impersonalism gradually to the devotee. So his thought is very much like the thought of any modern man, and so following his train of thought you can see a natural and necessary progression of thought, rather than just, you know, become a devotee and surrender to Krishna. But if you read his history, people think, oh, I can relate to that, I can relate to that, and I can see this thing because I'm thinking like this, and I can see I'm thinking like this, and but Bhakti Vinod Thakur just went to that next step in understanding, and I can see I need to do that. They can't go 100 steps in understanding, but from his life they can see I need to take that next step. So these things are all there to help guide us so that we can follow the instructions of Srimad Bhagavatam by precept and example. But yes, they are perfect from the very beginning. Prabhupada is another interesting example. Prabhupada, when he, in one of the first, I don't think it was the first one, but it was one of the first meetings with Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. he went in, and Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati was sitting on a couch. So Prabhupada just went and sat next to him. And then, you know, gradually he noticed that everyone else was sitting on the floor. And he understood that. So Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur never said anything, nor did anyone else. But he understood it was a mistake, and that you know. So after that, he came. But you know, sometimes, so it seemed like you know, the you know, like an immature devotee, you know, making a mistake. And we see that with some of the acharyas now, you know, and Sabhidaga Maharaj, and you know, Tamal Krishna Maharaj, and some of the acharyas, some of their activities with Srila Prabhupada, you know, where they did something quite foolish, and you know, so. But we learn from all of these things, and they are in essence, sometimes they are foolish. And sometimes they're actually part of Krishna's plan for someone who's already, you know, a perfected soul. It just gives those who come after them an ability to follow in their footsteps. yeah, so one of the things we look at here is that So Maharaj Yudhisthira took up the rule. One of the things we have to discuss is what are some of the aspects of the world situation created by Maharaj Yudhisthira's reign? Maybe we should list them on the board. And of course, this is question 3 in those homework questions. From verses 3 to 6. I actually got a couple out of the first few verses as well, but the question only asked about verses 3 to 6. Let's have a look at those. Personally, I looked at that in three categories. One is, you know, the political rule. One is the the within the mass of people, and the other one was within the environment. So, what conditions? You can name some. Okay, so we had all the rainfall required. Rainfall. And it was regulated. Yep. Lots of milk. The earth. All requirements, right? What did we get? We got grains and jewels, right? Because when we have rainfall at the right time, mixed with certain astrological timings, the earth and the seas will produce jewels. And of course, what's the statement Srila Prabhupada makes about those two, milk and land?
If the Lord is pleased, every part of nature will be
there. Yeah, that's one of them. There's another one, very important statement about there. So, okay, if the Lord is pleased, where is that from?
This is from...
which verse?
From the verse 5.
Verse 5, yeah. So... I actually put that down myself as one of the conditions that were existing, is actually the Lord was pleased. It is a principle, but it's also it's one of the conditions of the political rule. The Lord was actually pleased with the way everything was being managed. Do we have that condition now? No, therefore it's a condition which existed at the time of Maharaj Yudhisthira. Yes, the Pandavas cooperated. Now, it's very interesting that I think it was in England just now, just yesterday, there were two brothers going for the same political post. You know, some has something to do with the running the country, way up there somewhere. When one brother won, the other one said he would not work with him, and he'll maybe come back to politics after his reign. So there you see, you know, brothers, and you'd think, oh, I'll work with my brother, but he particularly won't even enter, he won't stay in politics as long as he has to work with his brother. And they're running, you know, against each other at the same post. So, very unusual. And actually, you know, Prabhupada describes in one of his quotes that somewhere. Can't find it just now, but Prabhupada is describing that you know, he didn't rule alone. He ruled with his brothers, and you know, it was an essential ingredient to have that cooperation, as to the fact that everything went nicely. You know, Yudhisthira could not really have done it on his own. Somewhere there. Okay, I've got a quote written down. what factors in Maharaj Yudhisthira's rule were present then, but are certainly not present now, that allowed these wonderful, you know, conditions and blessings to be present? One, the Lord was pleased. He had the cooperation of the Pandavas.
Caring of the lesser animals, the lower
animals. It wasn't partial, was it? There's another quote there. I'll see if I can find it. But he was impartial. Protecting all citizens. Yeah, Prabhupada defines a citizen as anyone born, you know, within the jurisdiction of that leader. That means insects, birds, plants. Anyone who takes birth is a citizen. So, yeah. Do we see that now? No. Citizens means in our context, you know, who is a citizen? A human. And
one who
cast their votes is a human. Yes, it's a fact. So, you know, there's some nice quotes. We'll have a look at them as we come to them. Other things? Yes. He actually represented the Lord. Alright? Represented the Lord and looked after the welfare of all people. No. So he's represented the Lord, means that no personal agenda or ideology. Do we see that now? So these are, you know, when you look at them, you would consider, you know, you think, oh, you know, how could you possibly rule without these components? And yet we see that none of them are present today. What else? Okay, so then, there was no illness, you know, physical and mental. Yeah, the we say we put that under seasons, you know, regulated or sort of pleasant and regulated seasonal conditions. Yeah, do we get that now? What else do we? He ruled the whole world. There's one flag. What enabled him to do that? Why can't people make decisions that everyone is happy about? Please. And the people fight over every decision. How could he make decisions? Autocratic dictator? No, it was an autocrat, yeah. But what? If you want to be an autocrat today, you've got to rule the whole world, means that you know, that decision is abided by everyone. So what sort of decisions do you have to be making? The decisions which are universally applicable. Yeah, what do we got here? Prabhupada mentions in the purport to the third verse that, you know, because he was a representative of the infallible Lord, the principles were infallible and universal. Principles have to be without fault in order to be universal, because he represented the infallible Lord. The principles were infallible, without fault, and because they are infallible, they can be applied universally. We cannot apply our laws and rules universally because they're so full of faults. As soon as we apply something, it disturbs someone greatly. We're talking about the principles of ruling. That means that you know, to rule you have to present laws that must be followed. So the laws that he presented that were followed were the Vanashram Dham. As we see, everywhere in society there is an intellectual class, a ruling class, a Vaishya class, Sudra class. So they're naturally there. So to base your rules and regulations upon a natural system is an infallible system, like this. So these principles are infallible and universal. Communism, the rules of communism, they're faulty because you make everyone equal. That's a faulty principle. Because it's a faulty principle, it cannot be applied universally. There will always be someone who wants to break the rule and become a leader. So now you mentioned he was an autocratic. There was one flag, you know, he was autocratic. It's also discussed in the purport of the third verse. You know, he was fully trained as an autocratic ruler. He was a trained autocratic ruler. The training was to how to represent the Lord's infallible plan. He was trained in that. Part of that training is not to have an agenda or, you know, ideology of your own, just to represent the Lord. That's part of the training. If someone is untrained, they cannot be an autocratic ruler. was that? It is a one man show, yeah. It's So that's part of the training of an autocratic ruler, is that you have to be able to seek advice from ministers, to be able to select amongst your ministers who's actually giving good advice and who's not, to be able to take the proper advice and execute it. So a well-trained autocratic ruler will do that. Duryodhana couldn't do that. He also wanted to be an autocratic ruler, but could not take advice from the right ministers, and even when getting advice from correct ministers, wouldn't follow it. So he didn't have the training to be an autocratic ruler, as Maharaj Yudhisthira did. He still had to make personal decisions And then he had to have the when he made a decision, he had to be respected enough that, you know, people will follow us, even if it's a hard decision, and even if it's difficult for them to understand, you know, where that decision's going. They have to have the faith and the respect to follow it. That's, you know, that's his. You know, it takes some training to have that sort of character, and of course, a lot of that, you know, he could be an autocratic ruler because people knew he was honest, and that he had the welfare of the citizens at heart. He treated them so. Therefore, you know, because of the training in his character, people could put trust in him. Yes, you can be an autocratic ruler. If you can't trust someone, their character, you know, they can't be an autocratic ruler, because as soon as there's a hard decision where you don't understand their decision, you're not going to have the respect and faith to, you know, follow them. But, you know, there's a certain amount of training. You know, he was trained and qualified as an autocratic ruler. Yeah, we have a negative connotation of these things because the Democrats only show us history of autocrats who failed. And when there is a history of someone like Maharaj Yudhisthira, they say, oh no, that is myth. So there is democracy, or there is Hitler, but they will not admit Yudhisthira. But, you know, so here is, you know, now one of our questions? Question 4, explain how an autocracy like Maharaj Yudhisthira is superior to a democracy. So now, how would you explain that, yeah?
One point is, even if they are as qualified as Maharaj Yudhisthira, they are only a puppet.
Yes, yes, that is, that's, well, no. Well, yeah. If they're not as qualified as Maharaj Yudhisthira, if they're a puppet. But he's saying that modern elective executive heads are just like puppets. They have no real kingly power. So in the fourth in the purport to the fourth verse, it describes there that an autocracy like Maharaj Yudhisthira is by far superior to a so-called democracy, in which animals are killed and a man less than an animal is allowed to cast votes for another less than animal man. Well, as Prabhupada points out, getting back to this one, that the basis of economic development is, sufficient milk and land. He mentions that in the purport to the fourth verse. The basic principle of economic development is centered on land and cows. Certainly one does not require flesh and fish, or iron tools and machinery. So I guess we can therefore understand that what was another factor that was present in the reign of Maharaj Yudhisthira was that he had an economy based on cows and land. Protecting cows and land, that was the basis of their economy. We don't have that now. We have economy based on, as Prabhupada says, flesh and fish, iron tools and machinery, the things that we don't actually require. cinemas, houses of prostitution, slaughterhouses. And there's so many nice. Yes. Well, their brains were still functioning in those days. You can't match that sort of, you know, computing. Now we have computers that can do all sorts of tasks, and the computer never thinks, do I even need to do this? Whereas the human brain will think, yes, there are so many things I can do, but do I need to do that? It's like there's one man who travels the world and utilizing his memory, and he can get a deck of cards, shuffle them up, he can go through the whole 52 cards, look at them, and then he'll tell you which each and every one. You ask him, do you know one slope of the Bhagavad Gita? So his mind is like a computer. That yes, I can do so many wonderful things, but one thing I can't do is to ask the question, do I need to do this? Can I do? Yeah.
What do we conclude for that? How is Maharaj Yudhishthira is even superior to democracy?
Yeah, that because it's superior to a so-called democracy in which animals are killed, and a man less than an animal is allowed to cast votes for another less than animal man. Right. You see that in the purport to text number 4. Right. An autocracy like Maharaj Yudhisthira's is by far superior to a so-called democracy in which animals are killed and a man less than an animal is allowed to cast votes for another less than animal man. Yeah. Yeah.
Like in today's term, no one, everyone is programmed thing, economic development based on the dollar figure or the gold amount. So in those days, they didn't equate wealth based on so called jewelry or gold or dollars. So is that an effect of time that this millennium is reversed?
Yes. The nature of Kali Yuga, of course, is that the essence of things no longer present or diminishing. So.
You need some money for transactions, which is done through coins at the time, those times, you may have land and all that, that's fine. But some transaction has to be done between the traders. It was being done through the coins. Now it's only plastic notes. Those days, at least, if there is no value for the coin, at least the gold coin has got its own value. Now the plastic note is useless.
Yeah.
At least they had three denominations in the world. Gold, silver and copper,
The difference now is that we're all being cheated, right? Which means that you're given something which has no value, and you're told it has value, but it doesn't. So you have a pocket full of cash and a bank statement or what have you, and you're thinking, I'm doing really well. It actually has no value, and because it has no value, it can be just disappear like that, whereas if you actually have gold, land, cows, you know, and a system where food is constantly being produced and, you know, and everything like that, you've got something which is tangible, of tangible value. So the difference is, in Kali Yuga, we're all cheated, and that which we have has no value, but we, being cheated, we think it's got value. So, you know, that's the difference. In that system, where cheating is taken out of the equation, then you're given, you actually have things which have real value. So that's the difference, the age of Kali. You know, so one last thing, of course, looking at here, that people were, you know, mentally they were happy, they were not in anxiety. Physically, we can understand, of course, beautiful, pleasant, regulated seasonal conditions and no unnecessary illness. What are some of the reasons why they wouldn't have unnecessary illness? Free from unnecessary anxiety, which is a big thing, yeah? Regulated in their lifestyle. They have everything sufficient, of course, for treating, you know, any problems that come up, just like Prabhupada mentions in one of his quotes about germs. Describing that, you know, the scientist's theory of germs is okay, he doesn't dispute that, but that he describes that he's personally seen that, you know, they have a certain herb, say someone has a tooth problem, they give you this herb, and it literally the germs precipitate from out of the tooth, which are then easily removed from the mouth, and germs finish. Just herb like that. You know, everything was produced naturally. They didn't need big medical clinics, huge hospitals. You know, the herbs, the diet, everything was there. They didn't have you know, the cancer. What's that? The psychiatrist, because everyone's in so much anxiety, they're just going out of their minds like that, and they didn't have the confusion. You know, what is the purpose? What is the meaning? Everything is so contradictory. Everything is so difficult. Everything is, you know, like it's just, you know, you take a pleasant walk from your home out into the field, milk the cow. Grab some veggies and go home and cook it up for Krishna. You know, it's there's not a lot of bewilderment there, back and forth. and everything, you know, everything's nicely organized. So, also, wars, they didn't have, as we described, the hot and cold wars. What does Prabhupada say about, what is one of the questions we need to know? That, why is there always a strain of hot and cold war between men? It is a reaction of the poor animals who, have been, you know, who are being slaughtered. Yeah, yeah. What else does he say about that? Yeah, another nice point, perhaps just to on this same point, that our society thrives on exploitation. Isn't that the very basis of our economy? Whereas here, Maharaj Yudhisthira was based upon cooperation between man, demigod, and the Lord. is a completely different system. That's described in the sixth verse. You know, unless one is pious and recognized by the Lord, he cannot make peoples happy who are under his care. This conscious cooperation between man and God and man and nature, as exemplified by King Yudhisthira, can bring about happiness, peace and prosperity. The attitude of exploiting one another, the custom of the day, will only bring misery. So, you know, we can say man, demigod, or you can put nature here, because all of the gifts of nature, of course, are controlled by the demigods. Man, God, and nature are the demigods. Yeah, it is based upon exploiting opportunities or people for your own profit. You're not cooperating for their benefit, you're simply out for your profit. You know, that's exploitation. Exploitation and cooperation are two opposing factors. Therefore, we can ask one final question. Why was the Battle of Kurukshetra fought? Mentioned in the purport to verse 2. What's that?
Undesirable persons could get out of the world and a peaceful kingdom under his authority could be established.
Yes, yep. Okay. We've got part of it there. Can I rub this off? Everyone got what they need from here? Yeah? We want a representative of the Lord. Established. And those who, you know, we don't want those who are not. We want the representative of the Lord established. Those who are not representatives, we want them. He wanted them kicked out. So that's part of the answer. What would be the next logical question here? It is off, is it? So it's just got a mind of its own? Autocratic lights. Yes, yes, that's right. Right? He wants, you know, the people to have the opportunity to go back to home to Godhead. He desires the mass of people to follow the right path of self-realization, which enables the living beings to enter the kingdom of God and to cease to suffer the threefold miseries. So they enter the kingdom of God and cease to suffer. So that's what he wants. The battle of Kurukshetra was fought to establish his representative of the Lord, to remove those who weren't, so that people could have the opportunity to go back home and cease to suffer.
In the same context, you know, when Prabhupada was successful and when he came back to India, he met the then Prime Minister, Indira Gandhi, you know, and he told her, you know, all your ministers should chant 16 rounds and you should hold the Srimad Bhagavatam.
Who said that?
Srila Prabhupada.
He said,
spoke to the then Prime Minister. And he said, you know, if you want India, you know, to come back, that's a good opportunity. But all the ministers should chant 16 rounds. And they have to listen to Srimad Bhagavatam in the morning. And then they can do their duty. You know? He said, you know, get along.
There you go. So an untrained person can never become a ruler of, you know.
And she was shot also.
She was shot?
Indira Gandhi was assassinated.
Ah, that's right, As the Prabhupada says, you know, they should take notice of what he says. He says that unless one is pious and recognized by the Lord, he cannot make others happy who are under his care. But that statement that someone else said there also, you know, the battle of Kurukshetra was fought according to the plan of the Lord so that undesirable person could get out and a peaceful kingdom under his devotee could be established. So that is correct, that part. There's that statement there. I think, you know, to make the statement more complete, we'd need to know what is the reason for that, and that is so that they can go back to the kingdom of God and to cease to suffer, you know. That's a real full answer there. All right, anything else you wanted to finish there? All right, so we've looked at some of the first five questions in our homework questions, Purva Svadvaya, and had a discussion there on the first, especially the first six verses of the chapter 10. And of course, that some of that discussion there is helpful for question 3 in the open book assessment essay at the end of this unit. Question 3 is select passages from chapter 10 verses 1 to 6 reflecting Srila Prabhupada's mood and mission. Discuss the relevance of these statements for ISKCON and for society in general. So, a lot of what we have just discussed then will be very helpful, you know, and directly related to that particular question, number 3. So, you know, really since we've discussed that so well and it should be on tape, we probably won't need to summarise that particular essay question at the end of this unit, because I don't think you should have any real problem answering that question in your essay. And all right, but if you have any questions at the end, you can ask me anyway. But I won't be making a plan to, you know, go over it myself unless it's something comes up. So now we're going to have a enter a little further into the chapter. Stroll a little more along the path of transcendental nectar. Let's look at the rest of the chapter. How many verses? I think there's about 30 odd verses. 36 verses. We're not going to look at each one individually. We're just going to summarize some points. So in this section, Lord Krishna then begins to depart from Hastinapur and going to Dwarka. And we hear the expressions of affection by the residents of Hastinapura. The ladies of Hastinapur appreciate their fortune in seeing Krishna, the creator of the universe, who's very rarely seen. And they also describe the glories of the land in which Krishna descends, and also, actually, in essence, they describe the glories of Mathura, Dwarka, and Vrindavan. And of course they describe the glories of the queens of Dwarka. And then towards the end of the chapter, of course, Krishna actually leaves Hastinapur and goes to Dwarka. Why did Lord Sri Krishna stay in Hastinapur for a few months more? Yep, Bhishma, so Yudhisthira, of course, particularly to oblige the request of Yudhisthira, and previously to show special mercy to Bhishma Dev, and also, of course, to show mercy to Subhadra, his sister, yeah. So
that will not come.
What's that?
Initially, for Prabhupada's request,
Well, at that stage,
we discussed it earlier in Mahaviru, that actually that is
it's sort of all apparently taking place around about the time of the funerals.
Yes.
So, whereas there's, you know, up to a couple of months difference in the Mahabharata. I think Bhishma Dev himself spoke for about 56 days. Mm-hmm. yeah. So at the very end, yeah, there's when Krishna was about to depart for Dwarka, you know, we can look at it that in this way, that every time Krishna tried to depart, one of his devotees, you know, requested him to stay. So, you know, we can say it like that, and that that covers all scenarios. So that's a correct answer, and you know, some of the prominent devotees there, of course, Maharaj Yudhisthira, particularly important because Krishna certainly wants to see his well established in his rule. So that's one of the main. Bhishma Deva also, very very elevated and very dear devotee of Krishna. And of course Subhadra, his sister, you know, so those in particular. You know, the incident of Ashwatthama, you know, no one would consider leaving, you know, in such a circumstance. So it's... Yeah. Yes. So, so Krishna takes permission, got in his chariot to depart. There are scenes of separation. Sudhir Goswami describes in verses 11 and 12, of course, we're going to have to fix those lights before we burn the whole temple down. That, you know, in order for us to get some glimpse of, we can never understand the mood of separation that they were feeling. So in verses 11 and 12, he just gives some glimpse to help us enter into that mood of separation. The devotees can never avoid hearing the glories of the Lord, even though they've only heard them once. So, you know, what to speak of devotees who are constantly associating with the Lord, how difficult it must be for them. There's a very beautiful lecture given by Srila Prabhupada on June the 27th, 1973, on the verse 14 in this 10th chapter, and it describes the mood of separation. If you get a chance, have a look at that. It's very, very enlightening on a very elevated topic. You know, how what's that? It's his Prabhupada's lecture on verse 14 of chapter 10, given in Mayapur, June 27, 1973. Now there are parts there. Srila Prabhupada discusses the mood of separation and how that relates to the devotees you know, in Krishna consciousness. So some very practical discussion how we can also practice the mood of separation as devotees. It's a very elevated topic, but he brings it down to how ISKCON devotees should be imbibing that mood in their day-to-day. So it's a very nice... We won't go into it now, but I'll just mention it. But you see that they were very much feeling separation, and we see that the female relatives, their eyes flooded with tears, they went to the top of the palace and they feared that their tears would cause misfortune for Krishna at their departure. So Prabhupada gives a beautiful lecture on that. Yes. Now, in the Mahabharata, it's actually at this point that Queen Kunti offers her prayers. At this point. As all the ladies, you know, come out to see him off. At this point. Little side note there. And now, after Queen Kunti's prayers, we know that at the end of chapter 8, Yudhisthira then requested Krishna to stay. Right? What's that? Vyasadasa. the one that's, you know, what's his name? I think that. What'd you say? That's him. Krishna Dharma. Yeah. The one you see up in the books, like, yeah, very, yeah, everyone, yeah, same one. Now I spent about probably about 2 or 3 weeks, and I went right through the Mahabharata and through the Srimad Bhagavatam, and I just very, very carefully, if you follow the exact conversation, you can see verse for verse where they come in the Srimad Bhagavatam, and therefore link up with, because Mahabharata is very chronological, you know, in what the Pandavas did and what they said, and when devotees did this, that and the other. It gives dates, times, everything. So follow that at this point. And therefore we also see at the end of the 8th chapter where Queen Kunti offers her prayers, we see that Yudhisthira, I think it's verse 45, he asked Krishna to stay. So, and then he decided to stay. So you can take it. You can take it in a couple of ways. One that, you know, much previously, in the Srimad Bhagavatam, Sukadeva Goswami is described where Maharaj Yudhisthira is asked him to stay, which actually would happen, you know, it would happen round about here, and he does stay for a little bit longer. And it's also within the realms of possibility that he may have been asked a couple of times and may have stayed a couple of times when Maharaj Yudhisthira asked him. He may have tried to depart a couple of times. Yeah, so that's also there. But anyway. But here, Sudha Goswami is, he's already described Queen Kunti's prayers, he's already described Yudhisthira requesting him to depart. So now he's just describing his departure. And he's already mentioned those, although not chronologically. Right, now in verse 16, there's some important statements which we need to look at. One of the questions we're asked is question 7. Describe the extra natural beauty of the fair sex and how it should be utilized. That's question number 6. Question number 7. Is it 7? Yes. I was listening to a lecture this morning by Srila Prabhupada. He was talking about Vaikuntha, and he was talking about when the men, the Vishnu Dutas, came to check the Yamadutas from taking Ajaneel, and the description, the beautiful description of the men, Vishnu Dutas, is given. And Prabhupada describes that the and the women of Vaikuntha are even more beautiful than that. So it's the nature of the fair sex, of the female sex, evidently here or in the spiritual world, that the female form is noted for its particular beauty, right? Extra natural beauty here described. So it was interesting that I heard that lecture, and he's describing that also it's there also in the spiritual world, the beauty of the women. It's the men are astoundingly beautiful, and yet the women are considered more beautiful still. Now here we want to know that how that natural beauty should be utilized. We can also see in the essay, part of question 4, appropriately present the principles of shyness and gender separation mentioned in purport to 10.16 to a modern Western audience. 4b is a completely different question. It's about chapter 13. So this particular topic is important in that it's one of the homework questions. It is one of the essay topics that you can choose from question 4. So what we want to do is focus on some of the significant points that Prabhupada brings up here. Work out what guidelines that we can literally draw from that as far as guidelines, as far as actions that we may do or not do as a result of the significant points that we learn from, and those guidelines, what are their underlying principles, right? So in this way, as the we want to be able to it's a preaching application essay. So we want to be able to understand this in such a way that we, one, understand it, and then we can actually apply it to a modern Western audience. So let's look at some of those points. One of the things Prabhupada says is, shyness is a particular extra natural beauty of the fair sex, and it commands respect from the opposite sex. Shyness is a gift of nature to the fair sex, and it enhances their beauty and prestige. So let's look at these couple of points here. Where else have we seen this discussion and this same point? That's a bit of the astrology coming out of me there. Which I should use. I won't use orange. That's more Mars. Okay. What do we say? It. It's an extra natural beauty. Respect. Commands respect. Right. That means shyness has prestige. Prabhupada says half-naked ladies in the street do not command any respect, but a shy sweeper's wife commands respect from all. Earlier on he says we have practical experience of this fact. Yeah. When Prabhupada says he has practical experience of that, he quite often tells a story, personal story. He mentions it in a few of his lectures, that he was talking with a friend in some particular room, and a lady who was a cleaner, so in other words, she was not from a, you know, very elevated material status, she stood shyly at the door, just like this young boy. Now you see how he sort of stood there, he looked around a little bit shyly. I had to let him in. That's what happened with this woman as she came into the door. Well, she stood there and she just looked shyly at Prabhupada and the other man, and because of that shyness, she wouldn't enter, because it meant that she would have had to sort of pass between them and, you know, for a respectable lady, of course, to just enter a room and just walk between two men is against the principles of shyness. So they had to move back out of the way and let her come in. Now, she didn't stand at the door yelling or threatening. She just, by her shyness, it commanded that respect. You know, that's the example that Prabhupada is giving here. That, and he says it in different ways, that, you know, a sweeper woman commanded the respect of many respectable gentlemen simply by manifesting a lady's shyness. those respectable gentlemen were Prabhupada and his associate himself. And it enhances their beauty. Yeah. Here, now we look at this point, that the material beauty of a woman is an illusion. Well, they have it. They have a saying in the West, I don't know where it comes from, but in the West they even say that 50% of a woman's beauty is illusion. They're not giving specifics of the percentage, but it looks like it's 100%. Just saying, the material beauty of a woman is illusion. The dead body has no beauty, so that's the whole body is actually dead. The spiritual spark is beautiful. So there's a discussion on that actually it's because of the soul's beauty that one is attracted to the outward body. Right? Now, therefore, Vedic wisdom therefore forbids us to be attracted by false beauty. So here is the point. Material beauty of a woman is illusion, and the Vedas are trying to protect us from that, Vedic knowledge, Vedic culture is protection from that illusion. Yes, we're getting that's the next point. Very good. That's how we're protected by restriction. Restricted mixing. Now of course this in the modern context does not go down well. Even though, as we said, it's a common statement even in the West that 50% of a woman's beauty is illusion, because we might give a little bit more percentage. And quite often a line that is used, whisper sweet lies into my ears, as one of the romantic statements that people make. So, in the West, they actually enjoy, the illusion, going into a little false world. It's all part of the pleasure. In the Vedic culture, they're seeing some danger in this. And they're considering that what is the danger, of course, is that man is like fire, and that is a man represented by Mars, and the
man is like butter, women is like
Okay. Well, I'll just change the symbol. There you go. Fire. That's a good point. Women is like fire, and man is like the butter. That's the Mars, and that is. I was having a discussion with one of my elder daughters that. Uh, she wanted to, you know, she was a little bit worried about how her partner was lacking a few, say, boundaries in his association. You know, nothing, you know, wrong, but of course the danger is it can lead to something. She wanted to have a conversation with him. She wanted to know if she even should. So I actually mentioned, yes, you should, because without the boundaries, in this day and age, people don't want any boundaries, and if you mention them, people get very upset. You know, that there should be any boundaries, that even though the man and the woman are in a relationship, the men want that relationship, but as soon as the woman places a boundary that, you know, or you're having a business lunch with this woman, he'll get very upset that, you know, you're placing this boundary. And also the same for women. And the difficulty is that we understand that without the boundaries, it will, you know, you separate butter from fire, because if you don't, the butter will melt. There must be a boundary. So it's that principle. But they don't understand that principle, and therefore men and women in this day and age find themselves in all sorts of compromising situations which lead to even unintentional major problems in relationships. So the Vedas are protecting one from, you know, just like you protect a block of butter, you wrap it up in paper or something, protect it, you put it in the fridge. Yeah, put it in the fridge, that's right. I think so. Depends what the room temperature is like, doesn't it?
The moment they melt, put it in the fridge.
That's going by that logic.
So this vice versa, so learn how to put fridge.
You have to say the butter is melted, melt water is
fine. Okay. Therefore, we have nature's gifts, as Prabhupada describes it. Is the shyness of a woman. And that shyness is the valve, as Bhishma Dev describes it. That's where we left this conversation. Bhishma Dev described that in his discussion on Varnashram. And he described it as the control valve. And Prabhupada it's the check to unrestricted mixing. So it's nature's gift, and it checks unrestricted mixing. Well, it's actually nature's gift, which means that it's something which is automatically there, but it has to be protected and nourished and you know, nurtured and cultivated and like that. So it's a natural thing. You know, I think you know, most, you know, as a generalization, you know, we generally accept women as a little more shy, just you know, when it comes to public speaking or taking the you know, limelight, you know, leading role, or, you know, in certain ways, you know, just on a world scale, we can see, you know, in general, that women are generally more shy. At the same time, of course, in Kali Yuga, you know, the qualities of men and women are all, you know, mixed up and lacking, and you know, polluted and you know, out of whack. But if we look, you know, if we go back, you know, just our forefathers' generation, you know, our parents' generation, and the generation before them, and we, you know, we look through history, and of course, if we go to the Vedic civilization, which is a very nice example of when things are normal, we can see that it's there. And
one of the things is, Prabhu,
yeah,
the women will not mention the husband's name, you know, but these days, 10 times I mention the husband's name. I've never seen my grandmother calling my grandfather by the name.
Yeah.
Those days are gone.
Those days are gone.
But here, you know, yeah, 1,000 times.
You know, yeah, well, that's
the woman feels that a little bit of a shy to call the husband's name, you know.
Yes.
But, I mean, those days, I'm saying,
yeah,
completely,
hmm,
especially in Western countries.
When I was a teenager, I went to Tasmania, which has always been, you know, a little bit behind the mainland. I won't say any more. anyway, in a good way, this example. So I was with a friend of mine. This lady had 2 daughters, and my brother and I, he was going out with one sister, I was going out with the other. Anyway, we went downtown and we pulled up the car, and the mother got out. She'd just lit up a cigarette, and then she got out of the car and she put it out and stood, and I said, well, you know, you've only just lit that up. And she said, well, you know, I'm certainly not going to cross the street smoking a cigarette. You know, she'd be embarrassed. You know, so, and many women in Tasmania had that sort of shyness. It didn't apply to the men, but just the shyness of the women, and this is, you know, not that long ago, but so you see how things have changed. Of course, you know, now, you know, like we know that a woman is only supposed to appear naked before her husband. Because these days, you know, they just get into magazines and, you know, television, and appear naked before the whole world. Some. And so, you know, let alone smoking a cigarette in a small country town in, you know, Tasmania, or, you know, calling out your husband's name. And that's, you know, how far that shyness valve has been let loose. and because that shyness there is, you know, being untightened, so the shyness is not there now, it allows the unrestricted mixing of men and women, and that allows both men and women to be in a volatile position, and where they can fall into the illusion of material existence completely. So yeah, it's quite a significant factor in society's well-being. So it would appear here, in one sense, maybe we can discuss this, that it almost, you know, one may say, well, why are you checking the women? Why don't you check the men? Huh? I think I could hear you thinking. So what would you say to that? What would you say? Like, you know, because, you know, say representing, how about we have some people, how about I'll be the devotee and you'll attack me for presenting something so preposterous as, you know, to ask women to, you know, to maintain that shyness. If you were the average Western persons, what would you say?
Yeah. The men were abusing them at home or abusing their power. A lot of people, like if you...
Yes. So if the women maintain the shyness, men will exploit them?
Yeah.
So, now, of course, who would argue against, how would you argue against that? Are we asking, does the Vedic civilization only try to cultivate good qualities in women? No, cultivating the qualities in men and the qualities in women. When that's both cultivated, the men behave themselves. Yes. If the Vedic civilization or ISKCON or anyone else was saying, yes, the women shall cultivate this quality of shyness and men shall just go on as they please, then you can, you know, yes, there's something underhand, there's something exploitive about that.
Yes, that's correct, because both have to apply, only then it works. Because
yes.
In India right now,
yes, yes.
The men do not appreciate shyness.
No, no.
They'll
exploit them, yes.
They want women who are well educated, who are ready to go out and do.
Yes.
They don't want people just to be stylish. They don't want
them. Yes. This is a very good point, how we started this topic, that people who claim to represent the Hindu or Vedic culture will take one or two points to their advantage without actually understanding Vedic culture, and they'll be fanatical. Oh, women must be shy. Men can, you know, exploit and abuse them in any way, which we don't see, you know, in Vedic culture. But, you know, women must be shy. So, this is one of the things that we're up against, of course, is that, and of course one of the things you'll definitely mention in your essays, no doubt, that in presenting this to the Western people, you have to present a good, clear, whole picture of Vedic culture, of where shyness fits in, you know, in cultivating the good qualities in women. And then we also have to explain, along with that, you know, how we cultivate the good qualities in men. The two must go hand in hand. but we see how crazy the world has become in the name of equal rights. The last couple of days they passed a law, I think it was in Germany, that because they don't want to be accused of discrimination, the government has granted that when women are breastfeeding, they can take leave from work, paid leave, and therefore the men also get paid leave when the women are breastfeeding. They passed that law. Otherwise the men would feel that they're being discriminated against. In the last couple of days, they actually passed that law. They're just going home to watch TV. Well, knowing them, you know, while the wife is at home breastfeeding, they're out trying to, you know, cultivate a new relationship. In a society where unrestricted mixing is allowed.
Vedanta Prabhupada in Mayapur, they were going to, I think, Kanjur 3, where Mother Deva Kusi and Kapila Dev passed and took the tribe.
Yep.
And there, most of the Prabhus who gave Bhagavatam lectures, they emphasized basically the qualities of a required for qualified woman, not of a qualified man.
Mm-hmm.
So even among in this society, that holistic picture is not usually being presented.
Even within ISKCON, that's right. That's exactly right. It can, and I have seen the exact same thing. even in so-called, senior, of course, means they've been around for 7 or 10 years as opposed to 1 or 2, who, again, really bang home this principle, criticize women, in ISKCON, and of course society quite strongly, and even to their faces, and even quite harshly, on these points, and allowing men to do all sorts of, not seeing that they should be helping to cultivate the qualities of men also. But even in cultivating these qualities in women, one should certainly not be harsh in one's dealings with women, children, brahmanas. We've discussed that previously. One has to be very careful. But yes, it's a fact. There's hypocrisy. There's a lot of hypocrisy, and we have to be very careful. Of the first, the principle has to be understood, right? So we have to understand it. It has benefits. This shyness in a woman is the natural gift of nature, which means the natural gift of Krishna, which allows the Vedic system to keep men and women restricted in their association to some degree. It's a gift, and that protects both of them from falling into illusion. That allows them to both progress on the path of self-realization. That's the purpose there. So we don't want to do away with it. What happens is when a woman is asked to be shy, usually the women think, and the men also, and this is where the misunderstandings come in. People don't, that women think, oh, you're asking me to take an inferior position. Women will associate that shyness means that you want me to be in inferior position, and men will think, yes, I want you to be shy because you are inferior. You see? So, in the conception of women and men, they're both, misunderstanding this principle. For instance, if a man who is highly respected amongst the Sudra community were to be given instruction by a brahmani, he would offer her all due respect, and in an inferior position that man would be very, very wary of disrespecting or disobeying the woman, even though she has all the qualities of shyness. Shyness does not automatically place a woman in an inferior position than a man. In other words, in a general society where 90% of the population is made up of sudras, that means, of the few percent who are brahmanis, they're all considered, in one respect, to be in a superior position, not in any way inferior, to the men. On another point, that here it commands respect. In other words, and Prabhupada has said in another verse in the Srimad Bhagavatam that actually women are more powerful than men because they can control men. And one of the ways that they control men is by their, shyness and, shyness and submissiveness. It doesn't actually put them in necessarily in a position of inferiority, but actually puts them in more of a position of control. So, you know, the problem is that we immediately associate shyness with asking women to take an inferior role. But that's not the case. That, a very qualified woman in society who has shyness still commands a superior position than thousands and thousands of men. And therefore we see that for the manhandling or rough handling of the hair of Draupadi, who was a superior, respectable person, millions of people had to die because she was a superior, respectable person who was disrespected. And yet Draupadi, her shyness, how does Draupadi's shyness in any way place her in an inferior position? And not only within society, but by her shyness and her, qualities, she was also able to, command respect, with her husbands, and to sometimes, almost control them at some stages. So we have to be careful of some of the jumping to both the men and the women misconceptions about what it is. That may be there. if there's going to be more suffering, more suffering is an inferior. If we look at history, for instance, let's look at the history of Negroes in the world. A lot of suffering. They're a race of people who have been made slaves, exploited, for as far back in history as you can go. So therefore we can see that sometimes, in general, just a real general statement, to take birth in certain races in this world produces more suffering. Right? And if you actually look at the long history of the world, at the exploitation of women, you would have to say that in general, when you take birth in this world, you are more likely to suffer through exploitation in the body of a woman than a man to some degree. We see that's why, of course, there's a long history of suffering of women and oppression. And therefore, in that sense, we can say, yes, okay, so it is birth that, can place one in a position where there may be more suffering. So, that's acceptable. At the same time, women are, they also have qualities on the material platform which are superior to men. Men can't have babies. So... you know, when it comes to, you know, having children, men can't do it at all. So, and, you know, so on in some cases, you know, there is superiority. In some cases, there's inferiority. But that is the very nature of material existence, that there are. In material existence, nothing is absolute. So yes, you can point out there's some inferiority here in this way, some superiority in this way. You can then, you know, weigh up how much inferiority is there and how much superiority is there. There are general statements, as we said, if we take all women for all history, and then there are statements if you take women in the past, women now, women in different levels of society, so we can't, you know, there are different gradings of all these things, and all these things have to be understood. Therefore, we have to be very intelligent, you know, to take these statements and not just, you know, as some men do, even in ISKCON, is to read something like that and then say, yes, all women are inferior and I'll treat them that way. And that does happen sometimes. So the principle is very valuable, and then we need to apply it very intelligently. The whole principle is so that women are not exploited. If we take the principle so that we can exploit women, we've missed the whole point. Right? In fact, the whole principle of the shyness of a woman being the natural gift of nature means that neither the women will exploit the men, attracting them with their beauty, engaging the men in a lifelong chores, unnecessary and completely giving up their spiritual life, and nor should the men, you know, exploit the women. But all of that exploitation back and forth between men and women begins exploiting each other. Begins when that shyness valve is there. So everyone becomes exploited when the shyness of a woman is that control valve is not there. I was listening to a tape the other day. Prabhupada was saying, in a relationship, the man is thinking that I am enjoying sense gratification. I am enjoying pleasure from this relationship. You know, and the woman is thinking, I am the one who is enjoying the sense gratification from this man, like this. The man is not thinking, you know, you are the one who is getting all the sense gratification from this relationship, and nor is that my aim. See? The man is thinking, I am getting the sense gratification, and the woman is thinking, that is the nature of relationships. And when this shyness valve, control valve, is not there, it opens up just complete exploitation of men exploiting women, women exploiting men, both in complete illusion under the bodily concept of life with no chance of self-realization. That's the problem.
In Kali Yuga, all this subtle body and gross body is toxic to the, because we can see, you know, men's gross body in women's subtle, men's subtle body, women's gross body, and women's.
Well, you don't know who's a man, who's a woman these days.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just saying,
all mixed up.
You can see men are very shy and women very rude, and, you know, all this mixing of subtle bodies and gross, completely disproportionate.
Yeah, so it's good to get back to the natural order of things. Shyness is part of the natural order. Shyness in a woman.
Really, but even in today's world, like even in the Western, even among the Western bodies,
yes,
the ladies who treat themselves very respectfully and do not mingle into or do not comment on certain topics or talk certain topics.
Yeah.
Even the Western men, you treat them with quite a respect.
Yes.
Like, we went to a restaurant like all of them are going to be all men. This one lady, she's around 35, but she really holds herself with a lot of dignity. And someone gave her a chair, and there was no chair for her only. And someone made a comment, because you can sit on the table. But because, you know, she lets herself into those kind of topics, whereas this lady always kept herself.
Even a very uncultured man still today will actually be controlled by the prestigious mood created, respected, you know, commanded by this chaste and shy woman, you know. It's a fact. Whereas a woman who's very vulgar and base and gross and lacking that quality of shyness, she's a target immediately for exploitation and cannot derive any respect, what to speak, from men, practically cultured or uncultured. Vedic society was very, very cultured. Again, I was reading this morning in the Markandeya Rishi Purana that, because I know that sometimes, as our temple gets smaller and smaller, you quite often find that as you're going through a doorway, someone else is coming through. Have you noticed that? we're sort of getting to the position of who gives way. And, there is actually a natural order that if a brahmana is coming through, you give way to a brahmana. You give way to pregnant women, you give way to people who are blind, deaf, invalids, very old, all these people. Sometimes I see that it doesn't happen. But also a prostitute. So, and that's part of Vedic culture, that because, as we see, that prostitutes existed in Vedic culture, because you couldn't restrict you couldn't mix unrestrictedly. So women who, for one reason or another, could not get a husband, they earned a living as a prostitute. Because you could not associate with anyone else's daughter or wife. And if there were men in society who wanted to associate with someone else apart from their wife, they would associate with a prostitute, and prostitutes were there, and they could earn a living from it. But they weren't like the prostitutes, absolutely, completely disrespected. They were one of the ones that you actually give way to if, you happen to be passing, on the street or something, and someone had to give way to the other person. The prostitute was one of the ones that you got to give way. It's not that, just this complete lack of... Even the prostitutes in Vedic culture, because still maintaining shyness to some degree or another, commanded respect. Even though a prostitute. Shy, I was going to ask you that. You're a woman, you should be telling me. Well, shy is it's the opposite of being bold or very forward, it's not necessarily a lack of confidence. It's not a lack of confidence, and it's not a lack of self-respect, which sometimes, again, it is misinterpreted like that. So in other words, a person can be very qualified and very conscious of their qualifications, but still they're naturally shy about putting themselves forward approaching others, shyness is, it's not an artificial sort of quality. If someone's shy, it comes from their just very nature, their very character, that they just don't want that they they don't push themselves forward on other people or push forward their therefore, the way they will speak, that they may want something, but if they're shy, they may not express that. Just like, say, we take the woman in Prabhupada's example, standing at the door, her shyness meant that I want to come through here and clean the floors, but the shyness prevented her from saying that. So she would stand there and just smile coyly and not say anything. Someone who didn't have the quality of shyness would just blurt out, "Get out of my way! Can't you see I'm coming through with a mop?" Like that. You see? So there's very little shyness in that. So the shyness is, it is a control valve that one's words and actions are sort of held back in a natural way, because one is not inclined to, just be out front or loud and like that.
To be shy, in that case, don't you need the quality of humility?
Yeah, humility is there. But it's not exactly the same as humility.
For humility, you don't need shyness. Humility could be part of shyness. But if you want to exhibit humility, you may not have to be on shyness. In the case of Srila Prabhupada, he was not very shy, but he was humble.
So, for instance, say a child. If you say to a little 4-year-old child, go over to that man. The child will come up. "Dad, I want a drink." "Oh, you just go up to that man and ask him for a drink." Because he's serving drink, but. Out of shyness, they're a little, they don't want to, But that's different from humility.
My understanding is that in traditional Vedic culture, the children are shy before their parents, and the wife is shy before the husband. The husband is shy before the spiritual master.
Yeah.
So in that case, shyness seems deeper than just external behavior.
Yeah, that's right. It is part of your character. For instance, Prajunda and other of Krishna's children, when Krishna would want them to come and sit on his lap and hug them and talk to them, and Prajunda would come and sit on Krishna's lap, but he wouldn't look up. He was like, because he was, shy. And that shyness also meant that he never discussed Krishna's relationships with his wives or especially the gopis.
Yeah,
You see, there's shyness.
But that shyness is different to the shyness which is talked about for the ladies. No? For the ladies exhibit a natural shyness.
No, it's the same shyness. Same shyness. If you see in the Bhagavad Gita, in the 10th chapter, I think it is, Krishna lists about 7 different qualities which he associates. These are the qualities of women, shyness being one of them. But in Prabhupada's purport, he doesn't apply them to women. He just applies those qualities across the board to everyone. We can find that verse. Where's one of our pundits in the Bhakti Shastri? 10th chapter, the qualities of a woman. These are the qualities. You're in the 10th chapter? You're in the room? Who's got a Bhagavad Gita?
Are you shy?
Ah. We're pretty much finished here, but
whatever you said, the guru should be the servant of the Krishna and the husband should be the servant, or the wife should be servant of the husband. I'm not ever shy. I've heard of this one. That's very good.
Do you know which text it
is? You got the 10th chapter? What's that? 10.34, is it? Really? Yeah. Oh. 34 verse. Krishna says, among women I am fame, fortune, fine speech. Is it really? No, memory, intelligence, steadfastness, and patience. Oh, I thought shyness was there. Let me see. Fame, fortune, fine speech, memory, intelligence, steadfastness, and patience are considered feminine. Now, shyness is not there, but here, the point I was making, Krishna says, among women, I am these qualities. Fame, fortune, fine speech, memory, intelligence, steadfastness, and patience. Prabhupada lists those 7 opulences. They're considered feminine. If a person possesses all of them or some of them, he becomes glorious. And then he says, if a man is famous as a righteous man, that makes him glorious. So he lists the qualities and describes them in terms of, you know, men and women, you see. Krishna is describing them as qualities, 7 qualities that you know, within women, but Prabhupada actually applies them to men and women. So the same. Shyness is like that. you see in the Nectar Devotion examples with Prajumna that he was very shy before Krishna. So, and the quote that you made exactly, that, you know, men, you know, before children, before their parents, you know, they're shy. So whether they're a boy or a girl, it applies like that.
In one sense, it's true, because Krishna is only male; we are all female.
Yes.
So we have to be shy in front of Krishna.
That's a fact. But shyness is particularly prominent in a woman. And it's particularly, and it is a reason for it. It's a natural gift, and it's one of the things that helps to. So therefore, women should not give that up. And by doing that, they become very. They command respect and prestige. It gives them a position of power. Power to the women, see. And it gives them an extra natural beauty. Alright, now I've got all your exam results, I've marked everything, both the essays. Maybe I'll just I can give your essays back. Okay, what I'll do is I'll give your essays back.
Do we
That's what I wanted to ask you. Kadamba Kanana Maharaj is giving a seminar on sacred space, and this is his sacred space. Our sacred space is becoming his sacred space. So, the question is, how many people are going?
Is it at the same time here?
Who knows what time it is?
It's from 11 to 1, then something like 2:30 to 4.
It looks like they're taking our spot.
Yeah, on Saturday and Sunday.
Yeah, Saturday and Sunday. Now, 2:30 to 4. Yeah. And you know, it's quite possible that they may go a little over time. Yeah. I'll give you the results from your essays. That's the wrong one. I'm going to give those back. So everybody has passed, which is good, of those that I've got. Slate there.
My mother will be emailing hers to you tomorrow.
Right, yep. There's Baylor.
Is this the
essay? Yep. Syria. This guy not here. And it's good. Okay. Now I've got to get yours, haven't I? Is that right? Unit 2? I've got to get who's that?
Yeah.
Back to Sarah. Oh. Bhaktisara, would you? Yeah. He won't mind. Who have I got to get? Nirmala Padmavati, P.T. Nityananda and the Suda. All need to give me Unit 2. Is it coming? On its way? In the mail? You gave it the office? Alright. Try and get those in as soon as possible. So you've got to do unit 3? Yeah? You've got to do unit 2 and 3. Because we're going to be going a little quicker.
First we'll give unit 3 and then we'll go back.
Yeah, that's okay. Yeah. But keep up with them, because I will be going through. My plan is to, which so far we're doing, is that 1, 2, 3 Saturdays, and we'll have covered the unit. Yeah, 3 Saturdays, we cover the unit, and the 4th Saturday is exam. And essays in. So we covered 2 lessons today. Yeah. So next time we will cover lesson 3 and 4, and then the third one will cover the whatever's left plus an overview, and then following. So it's important to keep up with the essays, exams, because we're going to move through. Is that so? No one will be here. Is that right?
We can come. But they have already booked
the chairs
on the.
Yeah, okay. Alright, look. What I'll do is I will be upstairs in Prabhupada's room, and I will basically go over the essays and the results from the exam. If anyone has any, you know, questions or queries about that or what have you, we'll sit up there. I may not necessarily sit there from 2 to 5. What's that? I might make it from 3 to 5. No, usually I make it 4 to 5. All right, 4 to 5, I'll be upstairs. If you want to see me about anything in the essays or exams, come and see me. Otherwise, that's it. All right. The marks are on there for the test. Yeah, I'll give them next week. Yeah, between 4 and 5.
That's fine, Trevor. Thank you.
I'm supposed to get them straight back, so that's why I'll do it next week. Yeah. Yeah. Sure. Yeah, certainly. If you have those details.
Yes.
Have you got my email? Or you can give them to me now. Yeah, that's fine. That's good. Just leaving. Yes.
They're still going. Yeah, something.